Hi, Guns Unpacked listeners. We do our best to make sure that episodes are timely and accurate, but these days, the world, including the world of firearms, is changing at a chaotic and fast-paced speed. Our commitment to building a better gun debate is not subject to change, but specific events, policies, and trends may have shifted by the time you listen to this podcast episode. Thank you for tuning in to in-depth conversations about guns that transcend the typical gun divides. This is Guns Unpacked, a podcast where we interrogate, engage, and elevate the terms of the gun debate as we know it. I am your host, Jennifer Carlson, director of the Bridges Initiative at Arizona State University, aimed at bringing research and innovation into the debate on guns in society. Today, we are joined by Dr. Cedric Dark, who is an associate professor in the Henry J. N. Taub Department of Emergency Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. He was recently on the board of directors for Doctors for America, currently serves on the board of trustees for Semester at Sea, and is the medical editor-in-chief for the monthly publication ASAP Now, one of emergency medicine's top 45 under 45 and on Elemental's list of 50 experts to trust in a pandemic. Dr. Dark has contributed widely to public debates on healthcare and health policy through numerous op-eds and media interviews in print, radio, and television. In fact, if you've heard the hashtag #ThisIsOurLane, you are already familiar with his unique voice in public health. So today we discuss his latest book, Under the Gun, an ER Doctor's Cure for America's Gun Epidemic, which explores the role of public health doctors in addressing American gun violence. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the first topic I want to get into has to do with the intersection of your personal biography and your professional biography when it comes to guns. And so much of the book details this. And I really found compelling throughout reading the book how you situate yourself at the intersection of both gun violence and gun ownership. And you do this in many, many different ways throughout the book. So I want to start with this question, actually. What was your earliest memory of firearms?
I think one of my earliest memory of firearms as a kid was probably kind of finding a firearm in my basement. My parents had one, maybe like a rifle or something like that. There are no bullets or anything as far as I can tell, but it's just something that probably, like many other random family heirlooms, that just gets moved from one place to another. Just winds up in your house, kind of stuck there forever. But yeah, I do remember that. I remember, you know, being told not to touch it, that kind of thing. But other than that, I never really owned firearms myself or shot a firearm until college.
Yeah, and your family wasn't like a gun-owning family that would go out shooting. So it was really not really part of growing up at all.
Correct. That wasn't one of the things that we did. I grew up in Maryland, suburban Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. Guns were not part of culture there. Typically, they're viewed more negatively, I think, because at the time I was growing up in the 80s, you know, you had things like cocaine and crack epidemic going on and a lot of crime. And, you know, it wasn't a time to be a young black man with firearms. That wasn't necessarily sort of what was looked favorably on, I think, at that point in time, especially not that part of the country.
Yeah, I mean, you navigate that in the book by actually talking about a family member that you had that was killed by gunfire. And I think it's just so powerful how you sort of talk about you were a teenager, right, when this happened?
Yes.
And you sort of talk about how you very consciously put it out of your mind, but at the same time, unconsciously, it seems almost undeniable that it shaped you and perhaps your career trajectory. And, you know, it made me think about how so often when we talk about or think about gun violence as impactful on people's lives, you know, we talk about the things that we can see, the things that we can count, and less so on these sort of unconscious and hidden ways that gun violence is impactful. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us about that experience and how it kind of informs how you think about the impact of gun violence.
Yeah, so what you're referring to is my cousin Robbie, who was killed in his mid-40s, which is about the same age I am now. He was an Army reservist, carried a pistol on him, and had an altercation one evening and had his own firearm used against him. But my only real memory of that event, I think, was really sort of secondhand, almost vicarious, from my mom, who wound up going down to North Carolina for the funeral and hearing about that. So it was one of those things where You know, I lived in, as I said before, in Maryland, suburbs of DC. My family's from sort of central North Carolina. And so the bulk of my family, you know, I grew up away from. And so even though I knew a lot of my cousins, I didn't really know them that well, I would say. So it was something that kind of occurred, maybe wasn't, you know, an immediate shock as maybe a family member that might have been living closer to me, but something that, you know, as I was working on this book, the thought came up and actually went back and talked to some, you know, my other cousins, which are Robbie's siblings, about it, about what happened, to kind of get their perspective on it, really, as to how it impacted them and their immediate family, because that was something that really we never really discussed growing up, and it wasn't something that got translated to me. But as anyone could understand, like being in a family that's impacted by firearm violence, which probably one in five Americans is something that does sort of transcend that experience and persists.
Yeah, and so, you know, you juxtapose this also with the stories of how you became a gun owner and also how you have thought about your gun ownership differently over the years. I'd love for you to just tell us how you came to be a gun owner and perhaps what that taught you about gun ownership in America.
Yeah, like most Americans, 72%, I think, of gun owners say that they own for personal protection, and that's why I initially became a gun owner. After moving to Houston, where I presently work and live, my house was broken into, not, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months after moving there. Quite frankly, even having lived in New York City, in Atlanta, in DC, you know, this is probably the most concerning thing that had ever occurred in my life in terms of, you know, having your house broken into and walking in one day and realizing that someone else has been in there, not knowing if they're still in the home or not. My wife, who's from Houston, immediately went to the store, came back with a shotgun and with a pistol. And at that point, I'm a firearm owner now. Prior to that, you know, I had shot a gun or two during college, but hadn't really ever had a desire to own firearms. But at that point, my hand was kind of forced.
Yeah, can I just ask, because I'm curious, I just feel like that dynamic. So there wasn't really a conversation. It was kind of like, this is obviously what we're going to do. Like this is what you do when your house gets broken into. Was that kind of how it unfolded?
There may have been a short conversation. I don't really recall it too much, but when your wife is like, "I don't feel safe in the house, I want to get a gun," you're not going to be like, "Ah, don't do that, honey." I'd been shooting before for target practice and skeet shooting and stuff like that. So it wasn't foreign to me. It was just something that, well, if I'm going to have this in my house, now I need to learn how to use it. So taking lessons and doing the range and kind of making sure I could understand, you know, the responsibility that comes with being a firearm owner, is one of the next things that we wound up doing.
Yeah, and I think it's really powerful the way you juxtapose sort of these intertwined, but often treated as like completely, you know, opposed aspects of being touched by gun violence, also being a gun owner. Oftentimes these two things are kind of treated as sort of two sides of an irreconcilable debate. I think that's actually changing. I actually think we're seeing more people come out on both sides of the debate, bridging that divide. But I'm curious, you know, if there was ever a point you were like, you know, I am a public health doctor. I'm now a gun owner. There's this friction I feel. There's a tension. Was that ever there for you? Or was it kind of just like, you know, this is just what's happening in this situation?
Yeah, not really. It's not a friction. And I think that for me, the best way to sum it up, and the real quote that comes to mind for me, is one that Dr. Esther Chu put out there, saying that we're not anti-gun, we're anti-bullet hole. And I think that's something that rings true for me. It's like, you can have as many guns as you want, just don't shoot somebody with them. Like, I don't care about if you own firearms or not, or if you want to have an AR-15, or if you want to have like some kind of, you know, revolver from the 1800s or whatever, that's your choice as a person. But you ought to be responsible about that choice to make sure your kids don't have access to it, or to make sure that you're not going to go and shoot somebody intentionally or unintentionally.
I was just at the National Research Conference. I always get the name, National Research Conference for the Prevention of Firearm-Related Harms in Seattle in December. And that's one thing that I feel like was actually really powerful this round of the conference is that there really was this sort of bridging across the gun divide in terms of, you know, saying like, look, like we can all care about gun violence. It doesn't have to be a divisive issue. Of course, though, there are people, and I think maybe more than ever in this moment, I want to be hopeful, who are looking to sort of bridge this divide. Of course, there are also those who are really committed to the gun divides as we know them. And throughout the book, you know, it's interesting because I think you have a lot of, you're very measured in the book, I would have to say, except when it comes to the NRA. And you are pretty relentless on the NRA. Obviously, there's a variety of reasons for that. But one, of course, is that the NRA made it extremely personal for you by taking on your profession. You know, I want to hear more about sort of your response to the, you know, stay in your lane statement by the NRA. But prior to them sort of coming after public health doctors, what was your perception of the NRA? Was that something that you were you thinking about them, or was it really this that galvanized you to sort of take them on?
I think prior to them attacking physicians, I think my viewpoint of them was I didn't really care one way or the other. They represented to me sort of an advocacy group for firearm owners, like a club or some other kind of organization. It's like the Sierra Club, if you're a conservationist. Like, okay. But when they decided to make that personal towards my profession, and specifically towards the people in my profession that actually do understand policy and are capable of formulating ideas and opining on policy, that's when I viewed them in a far more negative light than prior. But again, there are things that the NRA has done over time where you recognize that they aren't an organization out there purely for the gun owner, for all gun owners, honestly, because there are times when licensed gun owners like Philando Castile are killed by police and the NRA says nothing. You know, meanwhile, other things may happen that they speak up on. And so I feel like their advocacy is not necessarily advocacy for every gun owner in that context.
One of the things that I really loved about this book was the sort of story behind the story with so many of the key public health figures that animate this area of research, public health research on guns. I just love the way, you know, you obviously yourself, you share your own biography, but also highlight Megan Rainey, Emmy Betts, Arthur Kellerman. And I know these are your friends, but I also imagine that writing this book maybe gave you the opportunity to get to know them in new ways. And so I'm curious if you could share the most surprising thing that you learned about the public health figures that you profile, maybe something about their background, their philosophy. I'm just curious, like when you got into sort of doing the background research for the book, what surprised you even as a total expert in this field?
First of all, I am not the total expert in the field. The people that you mentioned are the experts in the field, I would say. Again, I kind of reluctantly went into writing this book. Initially, my thought was, why don't I just do a bunch of essays from all these great people that are doing great work and just kind of curate them? My co-author, Seema Yasmin, you know, who's really, really good at crafting narrative and crafting story, was the one that explained we had to have this through line, and that through line had to be me. So that's where that came from. I think that what I learned about a lot of them, probably one of the more shocking things is probably like Emmy's motivation for doing some of the work that she's done and how it came across, where she's in suicide prevention research and she had two members of her family that died by suicide. I feel like it's those personal stories that really impacted a lot of this and why people do the work that they do. I think for Megan, some of the impact on her, you know, is how she really intended to do public health and then transitioned into doing medicine, you know, which is kind of wild. I feel like I went the opposite way. I did medicine first and then transitioned into public health. But at the same time, I think as, you know, physicians that understand public health practice, I think it puts us in a place where we can talk about these big issues that impact society. And I think it's just a different way of thinking for most physicians to then also have that public health mindset or that public policy mindset. The very interesting part of talking with Dr. Kellerman at the time that I was doing this book, he was working for the federal government, so he officially couldn't say anything to me. He just referred me to a lot of stuff he had said in the past or had written in the past. And so even though I got to tell his story, it's also in the context of telling a story of someone that can't actively participate in telling that story because of certain constraints. And I think that comes across too with like Abby Euculus, who is the aunt of one of the kids killed in Parkland, who also is working for the VA. A lot of physicians can't tell the stories that we want to tell, either because of our employers or because of things like HIPAA, where we can't discuss a lot of this. And I think that's one of the things in my mind where This Is Our Lane as a movement shifted what physicians did. And I think social media allowed for us to talk a lot and show the public what we experience and what we traditionally have had to keep inside or hold inside ourselves, because we were finally fed up with being shut out of this debate and shut out of this argument. I have to thank the NRA for doing that, because I think we responded sort of reflexively because they decided to pick on us. And, you know, we're kind of tired of being picked on.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that, because I do think that that's something coming from the sort of squarely academic side. I think there's this sense outside of academia that like academics just like say whatever they want, and we just are completely, you know, unhinged in terms of like, you know, whatever we might say about guns or any other issue really that is controversial or not. But in fact, you know, thinking about, it's interesting that Kellerman was actually working for the federal government, so he actually really could not say what he wanted to say, as you said, thinking about his experiences in the early 90s, where the whole sort of apparatus of funding for gun research kind of hinged on, you know, this idea that you have these like academics that are just pushing a particular agenda. And I think what the effect of that has been, you know, even in sociology, where, you know, we're not getting funding from the CDC. Some of us are maybe getting NIH funding, but our budgets are much smaller. But there's this sense of like, you know, you can't do this research. You can't be open. You can't say what you really want to say. And I think it actually goes both ways, advocating for gun control policies, but also, you know, maybe your own experiences with guns or your own, you know, being a gun owner or what have you. And so I really appreciated, even if you couldn't get the information, like the narrative in the moment from Dr. Kellerman, but, you know, kind of even, you know, exposing that his biography is much more complicated than sort of what we might be led to believe in terms of this like two-dimensional debate. Is there something about this moment and everything, you can take this moment to mean whatever you want, that makes it more possible to be sort of open and honest and vulnerable and kind of scrambling the categories of this debate?
For me, I think it was a pivotal moment that changed the way physicians in general reacted to these mass incidents of gun violence, as well as just our general approach. Now, I think there are people that have been doing this for the longest time that have been advocates in this space, and Joseph Sacrin's one of them, but there are many others that are in this space, and I don't think it necessarily changed anything for them. I think that it sort of allowed them to find more allies than they may have had in the past. And I think it's allowed us as physicians to realize, rightfully so, more of our role in dealing with societal ills, whether that happens to be from firearm violence or from other topics. You know, I think I've seen people talk about This Is Our Lane in the context of things like climate change or any other kind of bigger, broader policy issue. And for me, and this is one of the reasons why you'll see me sprinkle in a lot of Rudolf Virchow into this book, is that I'm a firm believer in what he said, that medicine is a social science and politics is just medicine at large scale, and things along the lines of physicians are the natural attorneys for the poor, and that it's our role as a physician to really care about our society and not just the patient in front of us. And I think when you merge that with public health, then you see as a physician that, yes, we have to get outside of the four walls of the clinic or the four walls of the hospital and engage publicly with our communities.
Yeah. And that was actually going to be my next question. Like, how do you think of, like, how do you define public health? But you just did it. One thing, though, that I think especially, I mean, we could take it back to the early 90s with public health research and gun research. We could take it back to 2020. I think the words public health mean different things to different people. Thinking about sort of the negative aspects that people, I think, maybe uniquely in the United States, attached to the words public health. You know, can you tell us a little bit about your take on what people are hearing when they hear the words public health and how to sort of change that immediate sort of sense of, oh, this is a bad thing, this is a problematic thing? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the difference between public health and private health is really sometimes difficult to fathom. And, you know, I view them as like two sides of the same coin. But I think in reality, there's a large gray area between the two. And I think COVID exposed that, number one, because the private health aspect is, am I going to take a vaccine against a disease that probably one of the wildest diseases I've ever seen in my life about what it can do to a patient? And you have to make a call individually, well, do I want to get vaccinated? That's the private medicine aspect of it. From a physician-patient standpoint, you can sit there and you can debate with an individual patient the pros and cons of taking a vaccination or something that, you know, if you're 20 years old, maybe the side effects of, or the consequences of the infection may not be as bad as if you're a 70-year-old, right? But from the public health standpoint, you know, when you're talking about a disease that is running rampant through society and you need to achieve something like herd immunity, if at all possible, or in what's probably more reasonably the case, making sure that every single hospital bed isn't full, which at one point it was, you have to decide, well, which measures are we going to put on people, right? Whether that's vaccination or masking or social distancing or shutdowns, those are the public health measures that have to go into play. And, you know, I think the public got to see this probably for the first time in its memory for most people, how public health works and what public health powers are. You know, I think our society is going to sort of be considering this, how public health differs from private medicine, for a long time now, and reconsidering that relationship between those two.
And I'm curious if you're hopeful, because in the U.S., I think we really like the illusion that we are in control of our destinies, including our medical destinies. You know, in some ways, public health, I mean, obviously in the long view, obviously from a macro level, social level, public health is about creating the conditions where people can make choices that are good for themselves with regard to, you know, their medical futures. But it also feels like government control to people who are not, you know, not necessarily excited about it. And I'm curious, you know, I should say we are recording this 6 days before the inauguration of Donald Trump as president. And, you know, I do want to ask about like the future question, but I don't want to ask that quite yet. But right now I'm curious, like, is there a way to make public health more palatable, more persuasive, more convincing as, you know, a really powerful tool in creating, you know, well-being?
I think that's one of the most difficult questions you'll probably ever ask anyone in my shoes. And I actually was reading something from the Washington Post today about Xavier Becerra, who's current head of HHS, and talking about the difficulty he's had dealing with social media and misinformation, disinformation. I feel like there's been a lot of damage done to the concept of public health over the past 5 years, and it's going to take a lot to get that back. Public health in general, when we're talking about the professionals that work in public health departments around this country, they have turned over dramatically as a result of the stress of COVID, of dealing with it from a professional standpoint, from personal threats that I think a lot of those folks have faced, there's going to have to be a new era of public health professionals that's going to have to come back in and still focus on the general mission of public health for society. Because it's, again, it's not all vaccines, right? Part of it is, but some of it, especially here in Houston, is things like wastewater management and making sure that you don't have like stagnant water and mosquitoes everywhere so that West Nile virus and other mosquito-borne illnesses are not spreading throughout the city. You know, it's dealing with stuff like food safety, making sure there aren't hepatitis outbreaks or E. coli or listeria outbreaks. These are sort of the basic things that are public health functions in our society that most people ignore or don't pay attention to. Building up trust for public health organizations is going to be difficult because what people do remember is, oh, they made some nurses, you know, leave their jobs because they wouldn't get a vaccine. Or they made me stay home for a few weeks because they were worried about this disease. That I don't have a solution to as to how we fix it. The other side of this too is we have people that are trained in public health. And I'm not going to name them, but they know who they are, that have literally sabotaged the public's trust in public health, I think, to a degree. And again, at some point, I think there's a way for us to debate certain things and whether certain interventions are useful, but I think it needs to be done in a measured way and a nuanced way that doesn't strike fear in people and doesn't twist science around to the point where people are distrusting of science in general.
And I think that's what the book does, is it really models what does it mean to take the evidence, look at it in a measured way, say, well, if we take this seriously, this is how we might think about policy as a result. And, you know, throughout the book, you actually have moments where you're like, actually, you know, this thing that maybe we all sort of think either does work or doesn't work, we actually got it wrong. And so we need to actually look at the data and follow that. You rely a lot on RAND Corporation's meta studies of gun violence research. And I just want to flag that because anyone who's kind of interested in sort of the really, really big picture of like, you know, how do these thousands of studies that analyze all sorts of aspects of gun policy impact on gun violence or whatever outcome related to guns, that's a really, really amazing resource to get started in sort of thinking about the big picture. But I'd like to know, in your view, when you kind of started digging into the evidence surrounding gun policy, what was the most surprising thing that you learned? Either the thing that, you know, we largely believe works but actually doesn't, or something that actually works and it's kind of surprising that it works.
I think one of the things that really surprised me is the mental health check thing, which is a part of standard background checks, and I think it's reasonable, right? In the first iteration of that RAND report, it said mental health checks will reduce things like suicides. And then as they did a second and third iteration, all while I'm writing and revising and rewriting the book, that became more of a null sort of evaluation. And I think it's one of those things that you have to look at evidence as it changes and be willing to actually change your mind about stuff. So that's one of the things that I found fairly interesting. I think the other thing that I find interesting too is we spend so much time and effort and animosity talking about things like an assault weapons ban. And when you look at the data from RAND, and I have to emphasize from RAND, there's no real impact on something like that. And I feel like for me, it doesn't make sense to expend all that much energy on something that is so divisive when the evidence isn't crystal clear in that sense. And I think people will point out different types of evidence. But the reason I'm using RAND in that regard is because that's what the NRA decided to choose when they tweeted their stay in your lane thing. They actually looked at the RAND report and they compared that to one of the policies that the American College of Physicians put out there to say that the ACP was going too far in its assumptions. And so for me, I was like, well, if that's the measure that you're going to choose, well, then let's look at all the other measures that you decided to ignore. I have over the past, I don't know what, 15-ish plus years focused on what I like to call evidence-based health policy. in one of my suits. It's actually embroidered in the collar. And at one point, I actually had a trademark on it from the Patent and Trademark Office. When you look at it, we ought to use evidence to make our decisions. And we do this in medicine. We've gone from an era where medicine was snake oil and turpentine or whatever random concoction the roving Wild West doctor carried in their bag to evidence-based medicine. And so you now have the ability to practice science or quackery. You know, I feel that we should do the same thing for policy where we have the evidence available to do what we know is evidence-based or at least evidence-informed.
Yeah. And I appreciate you bringing up the point about the assault weapons ban, because I think that's something I totally agree that it's, you know, it's something that sort of sucks the oxygen out of the room. Like once that's on the table, it's actually really hard to talk about anything else. Yet it by and large does not have any of the impact that I think a lot of people assume that it must have. You know, when they see reports of mass shootings that are carried out with AR-style guns, it's a really powerful, I think the way you describe it, a powerful check on sort of what we believe to be true versus what is actually, the evidence actually bears out. And your point about mental health, you know, I think that's also something that is so important to recognize that evidence changes. And, you know, when we think about a political debate, we think about our views, we think about our beliefs, we think about our identities. And those are things that we don't like to think about as just changing, you know, with the flow of things, right? They're things that we want to rely on as sort of solid parts of ourselves. And yet, you know, when you take an evidence-based approach, you have to be open to the idea, not only that, like, what you want to be true may not be true, but that what you thought was true, maybe it never was true, or maybe like society changes, things change, people change, and the evidence shifts as well. And I really think that in this book, you do a really great job of actually like modeling this. And, you know, you mentioned before the difference between private and public health. And so thinking about these sort of, you know, macro level policies aimed at sort of, you know, the conditions versus the individual decision of, you know, you said vaccines, but you could think about like, how am I going to store my gun? Am I going to be a gun owner? And these sort of decisions. So I want to talk about the part of the book where you know, you're already a gun owner, you're talking about you're becoming a parent, and you're basically get to a point where you basically say, oh, you have this like aha moment where you're like, okay, my child is old enough where what I'm doing to safely store my gun is not enough, and I need to fix that. So you basically say like, look, you know, I had to have a moment where I kind of shifted my thinking. And, you know, this ability to take in new information, recognize that we weren't doing things right, or maybe circumstances are changing, and so we have to do things a little differently, and to actually change and be okay with changing, I feel like that is something that is just totally missed in our political culture, where we're so polarized, we're so partisan. So you modeling this in your book, I think, is just really a huge gift to readers. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how we can create space for people who, you know, at first the word that came to mind was open-minded, which is, I think, what we talk about when, or think about when we talk about evidence. But I actually think the right word here is vulnerable. So how we can give people the space to be more vulnerable in this debate?
You know, that's a very important point, I think. We need to be able to let people just have conversations with each other. Because I think when we sit down and, you know, one-on-one we have these conversations, I think we allow people that space to talk about what their beliefs are, to talk about what they are willing to compromise on, what they're not willing to compromise on. There's room in what I think the political scientists would call that movable middle, where we can have those conversations. There's also room on both ends of the poles where you cannot have any of those conversations at all. Because if someone is a diehard Second Amendment person, any form of regulation whatsoever is just viewed as tyranny. And on the other hand, a person that is purely anti-gun in all situations, they are just not going to accept anything that allows a firearm owner to have a gun and do anything with it, whether it's, you know, completely on their own property or not. And so I think you have to tailor your conversation to people that are able to adapt to information and changing information and are willing to listen to someone else and be willing to change their mind.
So recognizing that the evidence could change, that this is dynamic, what do you think of as your top one, two, or three gun policies that you'd like to see?
I would say, for me, the most important things we can do, and these are evidence-based things. Number one is a background check on every single firearm transaction, whether it's a person-to-person sale or from a store to a person. Right now, only 4 out of 5 firearm transactions actually has a background check run on it, and we need to, you know, get that other 1 out of 5 handled, because if I'm a criminal, I'm not going to go to the store, submit for an FBI background check. I'm just going to go down the street and buy a gun from some random person and get my gun that way and then go commit the crime that I want to commit. So I think that's the first thing. And some states have those universal background checks. Others don't. So there's room at the state level to fix that. I think the second most important thing is child access prevention laws. And this is one thing that actually Texas does well. And these are laws to essentially, if your child gets a hold of your firearm and does something with it, or in some states it's as extreme as saying, if a child gets a hold of your firearm, even if they didn't do anything with it, you might be liable as a parent. The third thing I would say is domestic violence restraining orders. I think most of us could agree that we think domestic violence is bad. And I think that most of us could agree that if someone was adjudicated to have a restraining order put against them for domestic violence, that they probably should surrender their firearms. I'm hoping that we could all agree on that. And if we can't, I think we really got some problems in this country where we think it's reasonable for people that are judged to be at risk of assaulting people are then allowed to walk around with firearms. And then the last one, and I think this is where we start dipping into those things that begin to get controversial, is sort of the age greater than 21 laws that we're seeing pop up. Because there's a few states that require you to be 21 years of age to buy a firearm, whether it's a handgun or a rifle. But I think that should be expanded. And folks will always say, oh, what about people that join the military? What about people that are like police, that sort of thing? Well, fine. If you go ahead and you join the military, you join the police, people have run a background check on you, you're probably not a criminal at that point in time, then you can be exempted. And as a 19 or 20 year old or an 18 year old, go ahead, you can have your own firearm. But for everyone else that doesn't want to go through that, maybe you can wait a couple years. So those would be the four things I'd pick.
So looking to the future, I don't know if you've attended the National Research Conference for the Prevention of Firearm-Related Harms. I think it's been 3 years now they've had that conference. And it's definitely a space that showcases the increasing interest among doctors and scholars in this area. And so especially for those interested in moving into public health and focusing on guns, gun violence, gun politics, what advice would you give them, especially thinking about what you see on the horizon in terms of the future of this field?
That's an interesting question for a person that does not view themselves as a researcher.
Well, I guess you could think about it in terms of what would you like the public health research community to be thinking about?
Yeah, for me, and this is kind of selfish because my public health degree is in health policy, so I'm very much so on research about the implementation of policies kind of at the state level, because that's where you typically have the natural experiments that form, where you can make decisions on that. I think studying those differences between states is important so we can figure out which policies work and which policies don't work. And we have a lot of research on certain subjects. We are missing a lot of research on other subjects. You know, I think one of these, you know, I actually just reviewed a paper for publication that it's not out yet, but it got accepted. And it's on defensive gun use. And that's one of those areas where there's not a lot of high quality research to even estimate like how much defensive gun use there is in the country, let alone how to judge the risks and benefits of it. So that's like one area. I think there's lots of other areas that we really need to try to understand that. One of the things I would like to get into doesn't even have to do with gun policies, but I think community strategies like violence intervention programs to see whether or not they actually are beneficial. I think that's an important thing for us to understand because I work at a level 1 trauma center. We see people that are shot all the time. What happens is people come in, they have these massive injuries, and they're returned to the environment from which they came. When we talk about a cycle of violence, that person or their immediate circle is then now likely to either injure someone else or get re-injured. Are these community programs able to stop that cycle of violence? There's some research out there that suggests they are, but I would love to see more and better research in that area. I think if I looked at it from those angles, that's probably what I would focus on the most. Because again, the violence intervention programs are something that we could fund that doesn't have to deal with the controversial stuff like quote unquote gun control, but it's something that every community ought to focus on. And quite frankly, if we find that they are evidence-based in work, then the American College of Surgeons, which accredits trauma centers, could easily just mandate that we have those programs at our trauma centers around this country. And quite frankly, until that mandate happens, no one's going to invest the money in the social workers and the other the violence injury professionals that need to be paid in order to do those jobs. Because all we focus on is RVUs and how doctors make money. And we don't focus on sort of the social work aspect that we really need if we're actually going to stop that cycle.
Yeah. And I think that actually ends on a, even though that maybe might not sound super hopeful, I actually think that ends on a very hopeful note because, I mean, you just laid out a very clear, easy path to, you know, presuming that, you know, how these programs are implemented, that it's evidence-based and that they're effective, but that's so much easier than having to solve the entire gun debate, right? So I think that's actually a really hopeful note. Okay, my last question, and it's however you want to take it. What are you reading now? What's on your bookshelf to read?
The past several years, I've actually created a little reading list and, you know, found it very interesting that I've actually read more than, you know, a book a year. Right now, I just started reading Star Wars and Philosophy because I am an avid Star Wars fan. I kind of like reading sort of these, you know, books that just explore your mind a little bit. So it's fairly interesting because it talks about stuff like Plato and Aristotle and Hobbes and things I've probably not read since high school or college or heard about since high school or college, but applies it in sort of a pop culture way. And I find that fairly interesting.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Dark, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a super interesting conversation. And yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Right. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.